We're going to see where we start tying in some of this. Actually, it really begins in the 12th chapter of Revelation, Revelation 12, verses 1 to 5, before we start in to know what we're dealing with here. And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth, and pained to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven. And behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his head. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child, as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. Now that woman unquestionably is Israel, because you have here a repetition of Joseph's dream. Back in the book of Genesis, it says this about Joseph. And he dreamed yet another dream, and told it to his brethren, and said, Behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun, and the moon, and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him, and said unto him, What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I, and thy mother, and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth? And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. The sun and the moon, obviously then, were Joseph's father, Israel, and his mother. 11 stars, of course. Joseph himself was the 12th, you see. So now you have a woman clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, upon her head a crown of 12 stars, unmistakably talking about Israel. Then you have the next thing. The woman was about to give birth to a child, which was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, a child who was caught up to the throne of God. Now, of course, that child who was to rule all nations is unmistakably Jesus Christ. He was born, of course, as we're reminded by Paul. He came, so far as the flesh is concerned, of Israel, of the tribe of Judah. And as far as ruling all nations, Revelation 19, verses 11 to 16. And I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse. And he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he doth judge and make war. And out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations. And he shall rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. And he has on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And as to being caught up to the throne of God, in Hebrews 12, verse 2, it says, Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. And, as Jesus himself says in Revelation 3, verse 21, To him that overcometh will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne. Now you're getting some more tie-in with Daniel here. The dragon that stood before the woman, ready to devour her child as soon as it was born, had seven heads and 10 horns. Daniel's fourth beast, which was the Roman Empire, had 10 horns. The dragon, of course, is Satan. Here you have the tie-in emphasizing the satanic character of the Roman Empire. Remember what it degenerated into under the emperors. In his early days under the Republic, they produced some great men of stern and great character, although even at that stage, their morals had decayed pretty badly. Under the emperors, it reached a point where it couldn't have gotten any worse, about like Hollywood today, plus more murders. So, Satanism, then, is the unifying theme which runs through all of this, showing its origin. The dragon stood for the woman to devour her son. Herod, the Edomite Jew, you remember, tried to murder the infant Jesus. In the second chapter of Matthew, we're told about that. He slaughtered all the male children up to the age of 2 in Bethlehem just to make sure that he wouldn't fail to kill the right one. So you receive again, if you ever needed it, further confirmation of the satanic origin and character of the Jews. Now, let's get back to Book of Revelation. We're going now to the 13th chapter, where we're beginning to come to the beast. Daniel says, I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea. So remember now, this beast is coming up out of the great mass of the non-Israel Enosh people. A beast having 7 heads and 10 horns. What did the dragon have? 7 heads and 10 horns. And the dragon, of course, is always representative of Satan. And upon his horns, 10 crowns, and upon his heads, the names of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was likened to a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. Now one beast, but having the composite characteristic of the earlier ones, so that whereas each of these had originally in its turn been all by itself a world empire, now you had something which would succeed them, which would take in all of these previous empires and have the same satanic character. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. And I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded unto death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast, who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemy. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. Now, It's interesting to note some of the symbolism here, where you're dealing with something smaller than worldwide conditions. You're dealing with a single kingdom. Why rivers are often used to symbolize the mass of people. Assyria and Egypt especially have been thus symbolized. And in Revelation 12, verse 15, speaking of that woman, Israel, who was persecuted by the dragon, it says, "And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood." Now that refers to the flood-like invasion of the Huns under Attila in the middle 400s A.D. You remember the people of Israel on their march out of Western Asia, around the southerly end of the Black Sea. They had to come up, some of them crossing between the Black, out of the southern end of the Caspian Sea, I should say, not Black Sea. Some of them came up around the easterly end of the Caspian Sea. Others came up around the westerly side of it through the Caucasus Mountains. And north of the Caspian Sea, they joined forces again, moved along the easterly end of the Black Sea, crossed the Crimean Peninsula, found the Danube Valley, and started northwesterly up into Europe. Now, it took them right across the path taken by the invading Mongolian Huns under Attila. So Satan was trying to cut them off from getting to their ancient homelands. The frightful numbers of these Huns, had they been and remained in the path of them, could have literally overrun them and exterminated them, or at least swept them up in the mass and mongrelized them. But God didn't allow that. God had promised in Isaiah 43, verse 2, "When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow thee." So when this flood of the Huns came to intercept and carry them away, God held them back until the people of Israel had crossed this path. The very southernmost portion of them were still in the path of the invading Huns, and the rest of them had moved north, clear on up into Germany and on into the Scandinavian peninsula. Now, the tribes of the Goths were being driven westward. They came in the southerly portion. They were in the path of Attila's invasion, and they were driven westward before it. And the Visigoths, the West Goths, starting from where they had been in Hungary, moved on across into northern Italy, sacked the city of Rome, and as I say, as a body, oh, they left a few stragglers behind probably, but the great bulk of them moved on into Spain and settled there. Then later, oh, a generation later almost, as the flood of the Huns was coming in now, snapping right at their heels, the Ostrogoths, the East Goths, split. Some of them drove north clear to the shores of the Baltic, where they formed northeastern Germany, and part of them split off and went westward and into northern Italy. And those remained there. They set up a Gothic kingdom that lasted for some years in northern Italy, though eventually they were overthrown, but their people remained there. And in Italy, you will find today in northern Italy, tall, blonde, blue-eyed people who were in no way related racially to the short, swarthy people of southern Italy and Sicily. And those are the remains of that Gothic invasion. But tying down now firmly our interpretation of the symbolism as to the significance of water, in Revelation 17, verses 1 and 15, and this shows you that the Bible is consistent in its symbolism. that it's being used the same in the book of Revelation as it was in the Old Testament. John said, "And there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. And he said unto me, The waters which thou sawest where the whore sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues." So, out of the sea, then, this conglomerate mass of all the non-Israel people, rises this composite beast that has in one beast the identifying characteristics of all four of the beasts that Daniel saw separately in his vision. The ten horns show that it's satanic, and they show that it's a continuation of the Roman Empire, which was the fourth beast of Daniel's vision. Then he says, "I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded unto death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast." Now, the head of the Western Roman Empire was wounded by the Visigoths in A.D. 410. Wounded unto death, it would seem. Because they not only took away everything that had been under Roman domination in that area, but they captured and looted the city of Rome itself. And then the Vandals in 455 A.D. and the Ostrogoths in 493 A.D. Theodoric, the king of the Ostrogoths, made himself king of all Italy. Now, Rome had changed from a military and political capital to a religious capital. It was of no serious military or political importance from about 400 A.D. The capital of the empire, in a political sense, had been moved to Byzantium, Constantinople, in 330 A.D. So, here was one head of the beast, wounded, as it were, unto death. As to what was happening all this time, the Emperor Constantine had issued his Edict of Toleration of Christianity in the year 313 A.D. Up to that time, paganism was the leading power in Rome. The emperors were deified and worshipped as gods, along with all the others, Jupiter and Mars and Venus and so on. So, Christianity became an officially recognized and tax-supported religion. At the same time, Constantine took upon himself the title of Pontifex Maximus of Jupiter. Now, just how much of a Christian Constantine was is something that is open to very considerable debate. He put up statues of pagan gods in Rome. All this after he issued his Edict of Toleration of Christianity in 313. In 325 A.D., this Pontifex Maximus, this chief priest of Jupiter, presided over the Christian Council of Nicaea. You had a great deal of division among the early Christians. Some of them said, "We've got three gods, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, and they're three different individuals, and somehow or other there's still one, and it's a great mystery because we have no understanding of it at all." And believe me, it was a mystery to them, all right. And the others said, "No, we have one God." And so they were quarreling bitterly over that, and this council was called at the demand of Constantine. He said, "You're not going to continue fighting over this. You're going to have a council and get together and decide this." Well, it so happened that at this Council of Nicaea, the Trinitarians outnumbered the believers in one God. So on the Supreme Court's famous one man, one vote basis, the Trinitarians won, and Christianity, which should have been a monotheistic religion, continued to be a polytheism of three gods who in some unknown way constituted one God. We, of course, know better. We know that we have one God who manifested himself to us as the Son, but he was also the Holy Spirit and the Father. Well, in 330 A.D., Constantine moved his capital to Constantinople, and on his deathbed in the year 337 A.D., he was baptized as a Christian. Up to about 376 A.D., the Roman Senate had a statue of Victory, where they burned incense to this goddess of victory at the opening of each session. The rise to power of the bishops of Rome began when Pope Leo the Great persuaded Attila the Hun to accept a huge money bribe offered by the emperors instead of capturing and looting the city of Rome in 452 A.D. And by the middle 700s A.D., Rome was really governed by the Pope. Well, this head had been wounded, as it were, unto death. But Charlemagne revived the empire in Europe. You remember he was king of Gaul. Then he conquered, made himself master of Italy and practically all Germany, as well as his own country, Gaul, which today we call France. He conquered and ruled part of Spain, some islands in the Mediterranean. So he became emperor, in fact, by his own ability. But in the city of Rome, he was crowned as Emperor of the Romans by Pope Leo III. This, by the way, was the first time that an emperor had ever been crowned by a pope, and is the basis for the Catholic claim that the Pope has the right to rulership over kings. Leo was there for a celebration of his taking over all of Italy, and while he was there, the Pope came out with a crown in his hands and put it on Charlemagne's head and said, "I crown you Emperor of the Romans." Well, as far as Charlemagne was concerned, why quarrel about it? He already was, so if they wanted to recognize him as such, that was all right. But the church ever since has claimed that authority. So Charlemagne ruled as emperor until 810 A.D. But they continued now to call this thing the Roman Empire thereafter. The Holy Roman Empire, because the Pope claimed the power to dispense this. So the deadly wound was healed. The people, remember it says, they worshiped the dragon which gave power unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with it?" Well, Charlemagne overran the Saxon peoples of Germany, the Visigothic peoples of Spain, both of them Israelites, as well as the various turbulent peoples in Italy. He was victorious everywhere. By 888 A.D., his dynasty fizzled out. The last two kings were known as Charles the Bald. We got a little too much competition outside. Whereas the founder of this dynasty was Charles the Great, the last two kings were known as Charles the Bald and Charles the Fat. And so it fizzled out. In the absence of a strong emperor, Italy especially was torn by constant warfare between the various petty princes and independent cities. Anybody who could conquer a village of 400 people, set himself up as a duke, and aspired to conquer a neighboring village of 200 people and become an emperor. So there was an utterly intolerable chaos. These people were constantly fighting among themselves. In other words, you never could live at peace in your own city. If the petty ruler of your own city was not drafting you into his army to try to conquer the village 20 miles away, the ruler of that village 20 miles away was trying to conquer your city. And they were in desperate need of some strong authority to put down all this chaos. So they worshiped the beast, as it says. Whatever city or petty kingdom was getting the worst of it always appealed to some other more powerful king for rescue. And the rescue always meant that you were absorbed into the kingdom of the rescuer. Well, while the empire lasted, it was the emperor's policy not to allow any petty kinglet to grow strong enough to unify Italy. And both during the times when you had an emperor ruling and in the intervals between, the popes exerted all their influence to the same effect. Remember, the popes already ruled some lands in central Italy, given them by earlier kings, and they wanted to extend their power. So Charlemagne's dynasty ran out in 888 A.D., and after about a century of chaos, the Italians called on Otho I, king of Germany, to come and rescue them from the Hungarians, who were at that time devastating Lombardy in the north, and the Saracens from Africa, who ruled Sicily and were seeking to take over southern Italy. So, after making two expeditions into Italy to restore order, Otho I was crowned emperor by Pope John XII in 962 A.D. And this new emperor, the German king, his new empire was thereafter called the Holy Roman Empire, and it claimed to exist as such until the year 1806, 160 years ago. Now, after speaking of this strange composite beast with the characteristics of all four that Daniel had seen rising out of the sea, John goes on, this is Revelation 13, verses 11 and 12. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. The first beast came up out of the sea, remember. Now this one came up out of the earth. And he had two horns as a lion, and he spoke as a dragon. And he exercised all the power of the first beast before him, and caused the earth and them which dwell thereon to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. Now, this next beast, this one that had two horns like a lamb but spoke as a dragon, this is the papacy. It came up out of the earth, not out of the sea. Now, the many times the earth or world has been used symbolically, it has always meant the so-called prophetic earth or world. They were the areas near the Mediterranean Sea and containing the nations which were covered by these earlier prophecies. In other words, when the earlier prophets talked about the whole world and so forth, they weren't talking about Germany and Scandinavia. They weren't talking about the American continent. They weren't talking about China. None of these areas came in any way in contact with the peoples who made up the prophetic world. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had another dream. He dreamed a tree which symbolized himself in his greatness before that period of madness. He told Daniel, and this is in the fourth chapter of Daniel, I saw, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and the height thereof was great. The tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto the heaven, and the sight thereof to the end of all the earth. Now, Nebuchadnezzar was an important figure in all the prophetic world of his day. These nations that extended from the Tigris-Euphrates valleys west to the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea. And that tree, you remember, was chopped down, though the roots were left in the earth, and there was a band of brass and of iron put around the stump of it and so on. It symbolized not the entire Babylonian Empire, but Nebuchadnezzar himself. You remember, he went through his period of madness to remind him that he wasn't as important as he thought he was. So you can see there, the earth takes in not all the peoples of the world, but the prophetic areas here. So, the portion with whom prophecy was concerned at that time, the Asiatic empires had passed away. The development of power was in the Roman Empire, so this now constituted the earth, symbolically, at the time of John's vision. Now, the second beast had two horns like a lamb. The Pope adopted the title Vicarius Filii Dei, a substitute for the Son of God. Vicarius, one who acts as a substitute in the absence of another. But he said, yes, I'm a substitute for the Son of God. And our motto is the original and only genuine, accept no substitute. So, he claimed two horns like a lamb. He always claims that he exercises all the power of Jesus Christ. He says that he can forgive sins or he can condemn to hell and so on. So he tries to adopt the outward appearance of a lamb, but he speaks as a dragon. His power has been exercised in the interests of Satanism. He has taken over the office of Pontifex Maximus, who was the chief priest of Jupiter. So no mistaking this. He exercises all the power of the first beast before him, the book of Revelation says. Well, he claimed the power to confer the empire upon kings and to depose them. He wouldn't crown Frederick Barbarossa, who reigned from 1152 to 1189, until Frederick swore that he would conduct a crusade to recover Jerusalem. And he excommunicated and deposed Frederick II in the year 1245 A.D. So, having horns like a lamb, but speaking as a dragon, he is exercising the power of the first beast, this composite beast, before him. In other words, there is a period in which the head of the composite beast has been wounded, would seem as unto death, but the deadly wound was healed. But in the meantime came this second beast that had horns like a lamb but spoke as a dragon and took over and exercised the power of the first beast before him. But getting down now to what we find in the book of Revelation, you get to the bigger thing here in the 13th chapter, beginning verse 1, where John said, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns." And when you get over into the 17th chapter, it tells you that this beast was scarlet in color, which again ties in with the dragon, which had seven heads and ten horns. I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, And the sea, of course, is symbolic of the non-Israel, Enosh, people in general. Having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns. And the beast was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. So here you see the characteristics of all of the four beasts that Daniel saw. The lion, the bear, the leopard, and this odd beast that had seven heads and ten horns. All these now were combined into a single beast. In other words, Daniel saw these things as the four empires coming into power successively. But John was showing the fact that these were nothing but several successive manifestations of the same power which manipulated these kings as mere pawns in the game. These empires were themselves only a part of something much bigger than themselves. And it says, and the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. This beast was definitely satanic. And that is this system which has antedated all these empires. It was in existence earlier. It is the same thing that operated continually through them. It's like in the case of pagan Rome. You didn't get any difference when one of these degenerate emperors was succeeded by another of the same stripe. It was still a manifestation of the same evil power, just under a different man on the throne. Then when you go over to the 17th chapter, he got the vision of this scarlet beast with a woman sitting, riding on the beast. And he was somewhat astonished at these unexplained things that he saw, wondering what they meant. So an angel comes to tell him about it. It says, and the angel said unto me, wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and ten horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And here is the mind which has wisdom. And some of the translations say, here is a problem for an alert mind, a wise mind. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And they are seven kings. Your King James Version says, and there are seven kings, as though this was something different. But the correct translation is, and they, the seven mountains, are seven kings. Five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. And the beast which was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goes into perdition. Now remember that John wrote this book of Revelation very probably about the year 94 A.D. That's about as close as we can date the thing. There's a possible leeway of 2 or 3 years before and perhaps 4 or 5 years afterward. But that's approximately it, in the 90s A.D. Now, when you compare this with Daniel, you're getting into something more than Daniel had. Daniel had a vision concerning only four empires. Now, we're told that there are seven in John's vision, of which five already are fallen. They've had their day and gone. And the fourth, the Roman Empire, was then just getting to its height in John's day. That would be number six. So what are these things which were great world empires in their day?
and have gone, and nevertheless are part of this satanic system. Of number one, you can take your choice of two. There's a difference of opinion among those who have studied this. I would say number one is Egypt. A very respectable writer, Seiss, would put the first one as Cain or Nimrod's empire. He takes Nimrod rather than Cain, but Nimrod's early Babylonian empire. I don't believe so for this reason. The Bible only goes into any particular detail about those things which in their day had contact with the people of Israel and influenced them. There's no mention whatsoever of the great kingdom of China, a vast empire covering an enormous continent and which goes back thousands of years, and it's never even mentioned in the Bible. There's no mention of the very respectable in material ways, though pagan and evil, of course, civilizations of the Aztecs and the Incas on this continent. Again, because they never came in contact in any way with the people of Israel. Now, neither Cain's original empire nor Nimrod's affected the people of Israel. And therefore, I would say that neither of those identifications are likely to be the correct one, and that Egypt is probably number one of the series. That, of course, Daniel didn't have, because Egypt had passed its peak. You remember that, somewhere around 775 B.C., Egypt was overrun and conquered by Negroes from the south. And they held it for about 75 years. And in that time, Egypt became the mulatto country that it is today, and all of Egypt's greatness was passed.